Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Wan Olekemi Olofunto Adegoke Badenoch is now the leader of the Conservative Party in Britain. And for as long as I've known him, my colleague Herman Pretorius has punted her as a potential, well, it'll take a while yet, but a potential Prime Minister of Britain. To this extent, I felt I had to invite Herman on to explain why. And Herman, you have to bear in mind, probably knows more about British politics than the average British politician. Herman, welcome. You have, as long as I've known you, you've been punting Kemi Badenoch for the highest offices, potential office of power, but certainly starting now with the being the leader of the much derided and sunk Conservative Party, and a lot of luck will be have to be headed her way. Why? Why is she? Why was she always your choice?
Well, it started when, as you say, I have an unhealthy obsession with British politics. I don't know why. I'm an Afrikaans boy from Pretoria. So somehow some of the programming might have gone awry because I just fell in love with British politics and have been following elections there for, well, as long as I can remember. The first proper election that I followed every step of the way was the 2010 election. And from then on, I've been hooked. All the way through the 2015 election, Brexit, the 2017 nightmare, 2019, and now the 2024. And when the 2017 election came about and Theresa May gambled big and lost big, one of the few interesting points from that election result was the election of a young woman to one of the safest Tory constituencies in the country, taking over from a former deputy speaker. And if you were to ask AI to draw up a British parliamentarian, it would draw up Sir Alan Hazlehurst, who held the seat of Saffron on Walden before Badenoch was elected in 2017. And her maiden speech in the House of Commons shortly after that election was just the freshest breath of fresh air you could imagine. In the post-Tony Blair, David Cameron, Bill Clinton era, where political capital seemed to be connected to how smooth and polished and likable and charming you could be, Badenoch struck me immediately as a politician that harkened back to something that we've lost, and that is convictions. Mm. Having ideas, having a view of the world, having an idea of what's gone wrong in the world and what should go right. I mean, just to give some context, when David Cameron was asked, why do you want to become prime minister? His answer was, because I think I'd be rather good at it. It tells you everything you need to know about a certain type of politician who's in it for what they think they could do and polish. But Badenoch, born in Britain, growing up in Nigeria, speaking about Edmund Burke and William Gladstone and Margaret Thatcher and freedom of speech and free markets and equality before the law and non-racialism, I mean, it just struck a chord immediately, and it was clear that this woman has an X factor that we haven't seen in a long time.
Now, what's fascinating about her, other than the background you've already explained, is she's not yet 45. She's very distinctly a black woman. And yet she, in a way, is almost a logical outcome of the fact that the Conservative Party has had an Indian Prime Minister, or Indian origin finance people. They've had three women prime ministers, or female prime ministers. And yet the Labour Party, the so-called Party of the People, well, you know, we won't drill too much down into that reality, has only ever managed to recirculate white men. And perhaps the unintended kudos given to her was an insult levied at her by Dawn Butler of the Labour Party, describing her as the black face of white supremacy. you've really got to be fairly narrow in your thinking, and that probably suggests more about the Labour Party than anyone else, to describe Kemi Badenoch in those terms. What was it about her that ultimately made the members of the Conservative Party choose her than somebody perhaps like Robert Jenrick, who's very much your sort of white male, your image of a Tory leader? Why would they, in this juncture when the Tory party desperately needs rebranding, rebuilding, finding its purpose after the disastrous election won by Labour and Sir Keir Starmer, that none of the factors that would ostensibly potentially be an anathema to Conservative supporters, why would the members of the party have gone ultimately for her?
Well, I think it is, it's a complicated question that cuts to this idea of identity. It's who Labour think they are as a party and who the Conservatives think they are as a party. And Dawn Butler and, you know, the likes of Diane Abbott, Labour politicians who've come up through the ranks, who've considered themselves trailblazers because of who they are rather than what they believe, sort of illuminates why the Conservative Party is, despite its most recent catastrophic election result, arguably the most successful political party in history. What it has done consistently for 300 years is able to adjust to new circumstances in terms of diagnosing what does the country need. If you think about the 1874 election where Benjamin Disraeli defeated Gladstone's Liberal government, what Disraeli did in that election and what every Conservative, successful Conservative leader has done since, is diagnosing why the country has fallen out of love with the other party. That has meant that they haven't always been ideologically consistent. This is a party that has been on the protectionist side of global trade and on the free trade side of global trade. They've been on the side of aggressive imperialism and they've been on the side of shrinking the British Empire through independence to the colonies. So the Conservative Party has an ability to get where it needs to be, that is in power, by reading what is going on in the country with a rare astuteness. And the problem with someone like Dawn Butler is that she believes, and she's probably right to believe, that what she has accomplished in her life has been due to the fact that she is a black woman. So then she thinks any other black woman also accomplishes what they accomplish because of their genitalia and levels of melanin. But the problem is Badenoch doesn't play that game. She's a pragmatic conservative with Gladstonian classic liberal instincts, but part of a Conservative Party that knows how to survive even the worst defeats. 1997 and 2024 are catastrophic defeats. And what Badenoch did, I think, that appealed to the members of the Tory party who elected her, ordinary rank and file, not politicians who thought this is a political calculation worth making, she's the right skin color and the right gender. The rank and file liked her because they saw in her a level of authenticity. She's willing to pick a fight. She's willing to be a bit pugilistic. And in a time of increasing identity politics through critical race theory, critical gender theory, Badenoch spearheaded the implementation phase of the so-called Sewell Report that after 2020 to 2022 investigated this idea of, is Britain a racist country? And she said it wasn't. In fact, she said repeatedly, Britain is the best country in the world to be black because look at where she has come, not through, you know, any special favors, but through merit and hard work. I mean, she's got a law degree and an engineering degree, so she's put in the hours. And I think the difference is that the Tory party saw in her what the opposite of Dawn Butler, someone who doesn't expect to get somewhere because of who they are, but someone who's willing to fix what is broken with a type of fighting spirit that harkens back to the Thatcher years, to, you know, the time when the working class sort of realized it had an economic and a democratic voice in the second half of the 20th century.
Well, she's got a very fractious party to pull together, people ranging across the spectrum as to what policy should be, what policy shouldn't be, how to fix things. Conservatives are not looking good. What is interesting is I saw an interview with Toby Young, journalist, a writer for The Spectator, and probably now better known as the founder and CEO of the Free Speech Union in the UK. And in his sort of straightforward down the line where he described having worked with her years ago at The Spectator, and he had no problem endorsing her, probably for very much of the same reasons that you've given: feisty, committed, clear thinking. One of the things, he was absolutely on board. The race event essentially came down to her and Robert Jenrick at the end of the day. Mm. And one of the criticisms, or one of the criticisms against her potentially, but in favor of Jenrick, was the fact that he's been fairly clear on how he would deal with immigration. It having been one of the, if not the most significant issues in the past election, and the Conservative Party having dealt with it too softly and too late, in essence, to make the difference. Can she make the difference, given the fact that that's been the one area that's been highlighted as him appearing strong and solid and likely to achieve a desired result in slowing down or limiting, if not stopping for a period, the illegal immigration across the channel?
So that is the critical question. And one of the reasons why immigration is such a potent issue is it isn't actually one issue. It is a multitude of issues. It cuts to housing shortage. It cuts to low pay. It cuts to places in hospitals. It cuts to places in schools. It cuts to every facet of basic service delivery that a citizen would want to expect from their government. So when housing, healthcare, infrastructure, when these things deteriorate at the same time as immigration being high, you can't blame the public for linking the two, even though there are probably arguments that the two can be unlinked at some point. There is this connection that if the state is going to provide stuff, it should provide it first and foremost to the citizens of that country, the subjects, as it were, of the crown. And you're quite right. Jenrick was clear on, having been immigration minister in the Home Office, he thought that getting out of the European Commission of Human Rights, the so-called ECHR, would be the way to toughen up the UK's ability to deport people, prevent people from landing there illegally, because the ECHR has been interpreted by Strasbourg courts and by British courts to be quite a catch-all. I mean, there are ludicrous anecdotal instances of, you know, someone, an illegal immigrant, not being able to be deported because they've got a pet cat. And it would be discompassionate. It would be mean. You know, it would be okay. So Jenrick very much said, we have to get out of the ECHR. But I think why that failed to win over a majority of the party is that when you're at the start of a 4 to 5 year spell in opposition, where you have barely enough MPs to shadow the government properly, just for some context, you need about 122 MPs to shadow the 122 government roles, and they only have 121 MPs. So they barely have enough to scrape by as being a functional opposition. Your first port of call shouldn't be policy, because you're not in a position to implement policy. So if you say we should leave the ECHR, fair enough, that might be the right thing to do, but you can't do it for the next 4 years. Mm. So it's sort of a challenge the DA faces in South Africa as well. It is, you're in opposition, you're not going to get into government within the next, you know, 4 or 5 years in many places. Are you just going to repeatedly say, well, we've got an alternative plan? It's sort of like saying, if you marry us, boy, you'll find out what a good husband or wife we are. And I think it's much better to do actually sort of what Thatcher did when she became leader in 75, also of a fractious and a defeated party, And she just said, look, let's just take a moment and decide, what does it mean to be a conservative? What do we believe in? What are we going to use thematically to ground our opposition and start building our case to return to power? And Jenrick has been appointed Shadow Justice Secretary, sort of the Minister of Justice equivalent. Mm-hmm. So he has now a portfolio in which he can gun for the ECHR and make the case against it. And the fractiousness of the Tory party, one can clearly see it from the few appointments to the shadow cabinet that has come out. Priti Patel, a foreign secretary, she was a competitor in the leadership race. Mel Stride, early competitor in the leadership race, now shadow chancellor. Jenrick, shadow justice secretary. So Badenoch is aware of the fact that her party isn't in a strong position, and she needs to balance at least three things. She needs to get fundraising back up to scratch, because that has collapsed in the last few months. She needs to make sure that she's got a coherent parliamentary party, that there isn't this backstabbing that we saw over the last 10 years, frankly, from Theresa May to Johnson to Liz Truss to Sunak. Mm. And then thirdly, she needs to make a case as to what does it mean to be a conservative, to be a Tory, and to stand on a Tory platform. If she can do those three things, she's got a good shot at overturning the political countryside in the Tories' favour within the next 4 or 5 years.
Would I be correct in saying that the difference can be made before that in how she's seen to lead the party in the context of by-elections, which come up, as they do here, frequently for a variety of different reasons? Because notwithstanding the stonking majority of the Labour Party, they got, you know, what, about 35% of the actual vote. And Keir Starmer has had the first 120 odd days in office have been generally considered woeful, heavy-handed, impinging on free speech, treating, you know, some fairly grim speech in the context of the riots that occurred after the murder of the three children in Southport, you know, extremely harshly, with clearly a bias economically. The plans that seem to go into how they're going to deal with housing, how they're going to deal with immigration, absolutely nothing seems to have a conviction other than of being heavy-handed, because that's kind of the direction socialists tend to travel in. Presumably these would be the smaller voting events that would take that could make a difference in that interregnum to the next national election?
I would say there are three such indicators that Badenoch would be wise to make use of. The first is her Commons performances. Tomorrow, Wednesday, will be her first opportunity to cross-examine Keir Starmer at Prime Minister's Questions. She's a feisty Commons performer. Keir Starmer is sometimes a bit flat-footed. So if she could start putting points on the scoreboard, just in showing that she can go toe-to-toe with Starmer, it'll be massively important for her party's morale. Secondly, of course, these by-elections, as you say, they are the mini indicators that can show whether a government is tanking or whether an opposition is finding its feet. And then the third one is the local elections next year. So within the first year, these are the three political things she needs to get right. There's party management things, but the political stuff she needs to get right is start showing she's a winner. Win at the Prime Minister's Questions, win in by-elections, or at least improve your performance, and then show you can win back in 2025. You're absolutely right. Mm. That's the route to show the next national election might be competitive rather than another Keir Starmer term. Essentially, Keir Starmer having won the first one on saying, look, I'm not Boris Johnson.
Nobody is Boris Johnson. Herman, thank you very, very much. Insight into a fascinating personality for a whole lot of reasons. And we'll watch with interest simply because, you know, as soon as unavoidably you have the dynamic of race involved, ears prick up, eyes widen, and we'll watch with interest. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Sarah.